Blog Talk Radio.
Cliff, your host. I had some interesting calls after Richard Thornton's program last week. And, you know, it's really tough when you have the academic world running your life, running history, running how we do things. And I really felt for Richard, and so much of what he tells us about the Native America perspective on America, what he's discovered in Georgia and in the South, really came to light, and I was thinking about it. As I mentioned, we have had Natives on the program talking about the migration of people from Central America. But I wanted to check in with Clifford Mahoti again, and I spoke to him a few days ago, and not only did he verify what Richard had said about a migration, he actually spins it a little more in detail. And we're going to listen to a recording I made in a second here. But it's really sad that this Richard's life's been kind of like turmoil, because there is a lot of fear about discussing the ancient past of America. And any deviation from the current theories or the current beliefs that Columbus was the founder of America, and there was nobody here other than some savages before he was here, discovered this country. That's the prevailing wisdom, and it's completely wrong. And I've mentioned this time and time again, and that is why are these academics not listening, not talking to the people who were here for thousands of years, which are the Native Americans. So anyhow, in a second here, we're going to hear from Clifford Mahoti and his thoughts on that. But before we do that, a couple of things. The network that we are on here, Blog Talk Record Radio, has expanded Earth Ancients, and we are now moving into a network. And I want those of you who are listening to consider the other programs. And I'm briefly going to just talk about a few people, and then we're going to move into the program. But we now have Hutton Pulitzer, who he considers is the history heretic. He will have a program that you can listen to, and I'll be promoting that in the next week or two. He's going to be on the Earth Ancient Network. It's very likely we're going to have some more people from the History Channel on this network, as well as some very well-known best-selling authors. But we need your support. We need you to be considering these other shows. And the only way you're going to be able to hear them is by going to Blog Talk Radio and finding the Earth Ancient Network, where there will be a number of these very important presenters, speakers, authors, and TV hosts. So I can't say that I'm working directly with the History Channel, but we are in a kind of a sideway move. And there'll be other individuals who will be participating that have been regular guests on TV shows, like the Ancient Aliens, like History Channel programs. I did mention Scott Walter. I'm not going to say anything about him being a host, but we will see. It's very likely. Okay, so let's go ahead and one thing before we go on to Mahoti's description of early America. I posted a very, very interesting article from a Peruvian magazine, and apparently in 2008, a series of geologists and other people landed, and they found an interesting footprint in actually it's not Peru, it's in Bolivia, and they have dated this between 5 and 10 million years old. And what's unique about this footprint is it's modern. It's a modern Homo sapiens footprint that was, the person was walking in mud, and the mud solidified, and over thousands and thousands of years, millions, it is a perfect footprint. And I've posted this amazing discovery of ancient humans on the Facebook. It's caused quite a bit of controversy because I read the article, which was in Spanish, and the geologists and the other researchers reached out to some European scientists, anthropologists, archaeologists, and other scientists to take a look and comment on it. And this is, like I said, this was posted in 2008, and it was I found it in just casually browsing through a couple of websites that I thought were interesting on archaeology of South America. And there was an initial response by this the scientists that were called on to comment, but to date, really nothing has been presented to the world, to these people. And I have been doing some research. There were some other independent researchers that looked at this footprint, but it's fairly amazing. And when you see a footprint that's of a modern human 5 and 10 million years ago, kind of changes our perspective on human evolution, and also begins to shake up those in the scientific community. It's a good possibility that those individuals who were called upon decided that rather than risk their careers in ridicule, they decided to just let it go. You can see this amazing footprint. You can see where it's at. You can see read about the expedition team that found it out in the highlands of Bolivia. On Earth Ancients Facebook, go to the group page and check it out. It's really the big one, the big post of the week, the big piece of news that I found. And it's pretty interesting, so have a look at it. Again, I'm going to mention that we are going to start doing some membership crowdfunding for the network. I'm going to be posting this program soon that you can contribute to. We're growing quickly, and I want to continue to offer you the best material that is out there. And the consortium of authors and hosts that will be working with Earth Ancients Network will present you programs, podcasts that are pretty unique, pretty interesting, and they will be presented by people who are the movers and shakers of ancient Earth, people that are bringing up information that is in some cases volatile because it upsets a lot of people. And there's just all kinds of great opportunities for some wonderful authors and presenters to have their own voice. And I'll be co-presenting this with a new producer, LeGrand Green. LeGrand Green is the former executive producer for Oprah Winfrey, the Oprah Winfrey Show. And since then, he has produced quite a bit of other programs, and he is going to be co-presenting some of the programs here. So we'll have the best of the best working with us to make sure every program is top-notch. LeGrand has signed on, and I'm looking forward to working with him. I have worked with LeGrand now for a couple of years on other projects, but I brought him in because it's a good chance we'll be working with the History Channel as well as some other programs that you can see on TV. Obviously, we're talking about a podcast, which is closer to the radio side of things, but without the heavy advertising component. So look forward to more information in the coming weeks, and I'll be definitely promoting it as we get closer to the launch date for that. Okay, so I want to play just an excerpt from the Mahody interview on migration of Native people into America. Clifford Mahody, as you remember, is a Zuni elder of the Kachina clan, and he is going to tell us a little bit about what he understands about the migration.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people, especially on the east and the Gulf states, and yeah, they used to have, you know, temples like they built down there in Mexico.
Yeah, like pyramids and stuff.
Yeah, well, but they were not because they didn't have any rock like they do down in. But they did have the mound. That's where the mound builders came about. Remember them?
Yeah.
And so, but there's also not only did they. It was not only one direction. You know, like say, like the Mayans came over here, and they came this up north and they settled. No, according to our history, it was a reversal. When they came from the west. It was there were so many people, and there's so many legends about it in Zuni and other pueblos that they had to. It was sort of like a lottery system, on the designations of which direction they're gonna go.
Okay.
And so a lot of them went south, and this is all in chants and rituals. But they had back and forth trade and actually that's why we still call each other brothers throughout the whole, you know, Mesoamerica, even clear down to South America.
Okay. Would you say that that because I've seen evidence in some of these artifacts of sculptures that look just like what you see in Mexico, some of the artifacts.
Uh-huh.
So are you saying that they started west and went south into Mexico, or they went back and forth, and that was a regular migration of both sides of the border?
Well, if you look at it from the standpoint, see, everybody came from the west when this was a new world type, new land type situation.
When you say west, you mean up from the Mu in through Mexico up into North America like we talked about?
Yeah. Okay. Well, see, this is why all our rituals are based upon that. When all the gods come from the west, and then that's where they say where the world started, I mean, I guess, in an inclusive of where the civilization started and where the people started from. And there's even stories of saying that they walked from the waters, and at that time the land was still so soft that they would walk and they would leave footprints behind, and that later on when the water receded, the water table receded, those footprints were left there, and so these are some of the legends that they talk about. But there's a whole history of how they went and separated. Some of them went north, most of them went south.
Okay.
And so, this is not the only world that they talk about. If you have any understanding of the Potlo, especially the Hopi, the Zuni, this is actually the fourth world that we're living in right now. So this must have been way in the beginning.
I didn't want to keep moving into that because he gets into the fourth world. But basically, it's very well known by Native people that there was an exchange of South, Central, and North American Natives thousands of years ago. In each area, they used the existing environment, be it limestone in Central America, be it stone, rock in North America, because they didn't have limestone. And to put it, basically what he's saying to us is that the migration came from the West, which would have been the place we know as Mu or Lemuria, into South, Central, and North America. And basically, there was constant trade. There was constant trade. Now, you'll never hear from an anthropologist or an archaeologist to speak to someone like Mahudi, because they just don't give them any credence, any validation, because they are not academics. So it's really sad that we have to hear that perspective, because there's so much rich cultural heritage that we are missing. So anyhow, Richard Thornton was telling us about what he believed, and this is a little more validation that supports his theory that there were trade among Mayan culture in the North American region. So I hope that helps clarify a little bit more. So anyhow, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. It's one of these subjects you can go on and on and on about. I totally support Richard's point of view. I think most of you know that I have a huge fascination for ancient ruins and megaliths, places like Stonehenge, Baalbek, Lebanon, and obviously the Great Pyramid. I've talked a little bit, and we've had guests on, about Sacsayhuaman in Cusco, Peru. But there's something unique, and I haven't really discussed it. I've known about it myself, and that is why these places are where they are. And I always bring up John Burke in his book, Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, because in his research, he discovered that many of these locations were built on geomagnetic fields, geomagnetic streams or ley lines or grids. And in some cases, there was a knowledge of these fields, and pyramids were built on top of them. And the telluric energy that bubbled up and into these pyramids, I believe, was captured and enhanced in some way, and as Burke tells us, used to enhance seeds, probably help with vitality. But there's so much more we just don't know. And my guest today has been studying and looking into energy grids, vortexes, for over 30 years. Now, this is a subject that, as an individual, I have just touched upon, but there's so much more that I'm very interested in. And today's guest is Beth Higgins, and Beth is actually she's an anthropologist, but she is a teacher. She's currently teaching at Goddard College at Walden University, and she has made a study of these vortexes, and I'm really curious to learn more about it. Beth, how are you today?
I'm just fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm glad we finally connected. We had a little trouble at the beginning of the program getting connected, but here we are.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. I was very interested in your description of yourself, that you're a Reiki master and that you have a strong connection to nature. So we will have some fun with this.
Yeah. It's funny. I haven't really talked to the audience about that. I studied Reiki probably 25, 30 years ago and used it in a lot of healing and always on myself. But still, with that knowledge, I don't really have the ancient wisdom focus. I think it's kind of coming on as I get older about these sites. And I'm really curious, Beth, what triggered your interest in studying earth energetics? Was it something as a young person you just were like kind of connected to nature and you thought, hey, there's something about this rock? Or did you stumble upon a mound or something and then that kind of triggered your interest?
Well, you know, it was really very serendipitous. This will date me, but I was a deadhead. And and I got a copy of New Age Journal that had an interview with Jerry Garcia in it.
Mm-hmm.
And behind the picture of Jerry Garcia was the first printing of Christopher Bird's article on the grid.
Oh, right.
And it was just, I mean, I think I told you this when we were writing back and forth, that I have a head for geometry. You know, I mean, people have all kinds of things mm-hmm. that really attract them. And what really attracted me was the geometry of that grid. And I looked at it and I thought, that's it. I mean, it was just that simple. And then I couldn't put it down because it, you know, it led me into the geometry of trees and plants and rocks and stars, and I just so much liked the idea that the earth wasn't just an aggregate of stone and fire.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it that there was a pattern and that it wasn't random. That kind of, you know, fed into a larger sense of spirit that I'd always felt, but that I couldn't quite, you know, the Christian mythology didn't work very well for me.
Mm-hmm. So
it was a head thing rather than an emotional thing until the emotion kicked in with that form.
I mean, obviously, Chris Bird's book is a seminal kind of a book that's spawned a lot of other research, a lot of other interests and things like that. But I mean, today I know there's so much we could talk about. I really want to focus on ancient civilizations and how they understood the electromagnetic fields of the earth, which are the grids, the ley lines, and the vortexes that are out there. And in particular, I had an eye opener when I went down to the Yucatan Peninsula for the first time, and this is like 1995. And I visited Chichen Itza and Uxmal and even went to Coba. And there was something about those places that was just pulsating for me. And I'm just curious, in your studies, do you believe that the ancients had some type of natural intuition, or was it more like they were wired to the earth and understood that there were ley lines that were these power grid systems or something?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I know some people have that. And so I can't imagine that a civilization that, any civilization that didn't have all the electromagnetic interference that we have now and the technologies that we have and the isolation from nature wouldn't have felt telluric currents in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tesla's proved that. To me, that's conclusive evidence. Right after I first learned about that, you know, the idea of putting the geometries on the earth, I met a guy named Toby Groats who was working with telluric energies. I don't know if you knew him and Tesla.
I don't know that name, no.
I don't even know whether he's working at it anymore, but he, early on, like in the early 80s, there was so much speculation about this stuff that I think I've just taken it to be true. I'm not sure, you know, there was, I don't know that the grids can be measured with scientific instruments. And I don't think that means that the energies aren't there. But I think you have to give, if a group of people feel that they're there, the connection of the minds will create grids, I believe.
Well, you don't think that a magnometer or some of the instruments that John Burke used would be able to pinpoint, say, one of the hot spots on one of these grids, these earth-wide grids? Like, there must be some maybe emerging technology that would be able to track something like that down.
It's very elusive. You know, I have no question that John Burke did research that I'll probably spend much of the rest of my life trying to work with. But I think that I think of a human being as a spinning electromagnetic spiritual energy. I think of humans as vortexes, each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have enough vortex is in the same place, there's no reason that to think that the energy isn't coming from the earth and going back down into the earth. You know, we are electromagnetic beings. And I think that lines of belief and lines of a pilgrimage and, you know, real electromagnetic phenomena that are measured all come together.
Interesting. With your academic training as an anthropologist, a lot of this early discovery must have been really hard on you. and I was looking at doing some research on you in 1984, which over 30 years ago, there's an article called the Becker-Huggins Grid. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's actually studying the grids and the vortexes of Earth.
Was this the one that was in Pursuit?
Yeah, the title was called Becker-Huggins Grid. It was fascinating, and it was talks about some of the research you were doing.
Well, at the time I was working with Bill Becker, who was an artist and industrial designer and geometer at the University of Illinois, and I was at Governor State, and we had been quite involved in building sustainable energy technologies. You know, it was right kind of on solar and earth energies research was starting to bump into each other. I don't know. Have you ever heard of the STEL community in Illinois?
No, I haven't.
There's a fellow there who would be great for this program. His name is Tim Wilhelm. And a number of people, David Childress lived at Stell. That's where I met David. He was planning to become an adventurer, and I was planning to become an anthropologist. And when we wrote that first grid article, he said that he'd like to put it into his Adventures Unlimited new publishing company. And it was really funny because it was just sort of a community of young 30-somethings doing all of this stuff. Mm. And my university, Governor State University, in 1980, shut down the sustainable energy programs that were going then, because Waste Management and Commonwealth Edison had said, you know, that's the end of that in our state university. So that was the biggest political hit that I ever got. But I figured, okay, if I can't study solar energy, I'm going to study earth energy. It was just that simple. I just changed my focus.
Wow.
And so nobody really ever came after me because they already thought that I was somewhere out there on the fringe because of being so committed to solar. And, you know, I began to realize that the interaction of the sun and the earth and the core of the earth, whatever that is, and the spinning made the earth an electromagnetic body. And so, of course, there would be a geometric regularity to where the that power came up to the surface of the earth. I mean, I see the sun and the earth as really in an interactive dance. Rather than the sun just shining on the earth. And I was quite familiar at that time with the Hopi story of Spider Grandmother. And just lately I've been talking with a Native American who lives up in Minnesota, who his name is Black Bear. And he's talked to me about the electromagnetic shield of the earth actually being Spider Grandmother. And that,
what is,
you know,
Spider
the
Grandmother?
Result is,
what is that?
Well, Spider Grandmother is the, do you know about the story of her and the two twins, Polonkoya and Powonkoya? I'm not saying them correctly, but
no.
they guard the spinning of the poles of the earth. And they're
tell
electromagnetic
us.
Beings, and she knits, you know, Spider Grandmother, with their help, protects the earth with this grid that mediates the relationship between sun and earth. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, there's just one grid. The one that we happen to come upon was based on Plato and upon the work of the Russians, but as I wrote to you, now many people are taking that grid that I turned into the Google Earth app, and they're sliding it around on the earth, and there are as many grids as with convincing lineups as there are people looking at the earth.
Let's talk about this grid now. Did you base your grid on earlier grids that, I mean, the grid, there's been a number of grids that have been created over the centuries, haven't there? I mean, some of them are estimated grids, some of them are esoteric grids. But is there really a knowledge of these grids being true grids of energy fields, energy vortexes, whatever?
Well, how far back, how far back do you want to go? Like, should we go back to...
give us a short
Asia?
History of understanding mapping. The mapping is what's curious, because I see in a lot of your writings that you show these earlier maps that were made, you know, I think during the Renaissance period. And it's how in the heck would they know about the grids during the Renaissance period? So, yeah, please give us a short history, because I think it's fascinating.
Well, the one that really convinced me was that Deaconestris map, which was, I think its date was 1263.
Wow.
And it was an Italian monk who was living in France who made this map. At that time, they were illustrating maps, continents with people, you know, so that they had the map has the coastline of North Africa going over to Giza and then stretching on into the Middle East as a woman lying down, and then on top of her being England and part of Europe as a man. And that's a very common way of mapping. But then there's in it a diamond shape that its four corners of this diamond fall on grid points from the Russian map.
Hmm.
And it's just
okay.
a clear diamond. And to me, that was evidence that something was going on. And the diamond is also called a rhomb. And the meaning of rhomb is from an earlier Greek root rho, which means rotation or spinning. And so somewhere in there, the connection of geometry and spinning and vortexes and the relationship to the ground, the landscape, I'm sure was known.
So are you saying that this individual in the 1200s must have used a different, an existing map that had been made that of known vortices or what? How would they create a map that long ago?
I have no clue.
Okay.
I mean, it was such a shock to see that map, but it's there.
Hmm.
And,
okay.
You know, that Egypt is known as the land of Mur, the land of the right triangle, various mm-hmm. variations of the right triangle.
Yeah.
And right at the center of that rhomb, or that diamond, is essentially Bedet, that point that's just off the coast of Egypt at the head of the Nile, or the mouth of the Nile.
Right.
And it's the rhomb is made up of four of those right triangles. And you can tie those right triangles right to the sides of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid.
Hmm. Wow.
I mean, there's a real lot of, you know, it's all circumstantial, but it must have been one of those worldviews that was so taken for granted that it just wasn't, you know, talked about. It's like the air or the water
yeah.
that the fish swims in, that kind of thing. That's what
I think. Would have been the next one after 1200? What would have been the next significant grid that is kind of maps the Earth?
Hmm. I saw one the other day on somebody's website that, but it didn't have grids on it, but it was an illustration of a rabbit and two leaves that formed the shape of the continents of Earth, and it was supposedly part of the Mahabharata, which is a Hindu epic that would have been at about 5000 BC, but it's written in narrative rather than drawn. That's
right.
One of the problems with those ancient, even Plato, you know, I think the reason the grid as we use it is exactly described in Plato. Plato's in the Timaeus, the geometry is identical to what Buckminster Fuller came up with.
Hmm.
But
really?
It's very obvious if you know this stuff that Plato couldn't draw, and I think somebody told him. And he tried to say what it was, but he gets all so garbled up in his words that the whole idea of it is lost.
Hmm. That's curious.
It really is.
Yeah. Well, tell us about, you know, your understanding of grids. Now, if they're not verifiable and they're making these grids, and would you say that they're all somewhat similar, or do they vary a lot depending on the individual who created them? Because if they're not verifiable, then these grids must be, I mean, you're telling me about a grid that you posted online that people have been using to measure. So are you saying, is that a grid of some kind of accuracy, or is it totally random?
Well, can I go back to those three Russians that made the contemporary first grid?
Yeah. Please.
There was a historian and a linguist and an engineer. And the engineer and the historian were right. And I went to Russia and spent some time living with this engineer. So I mean, as a guest, so that's where this story comes from. He said that the historian Goncharov had been playing around with the dodecahedron, which is one of the Platonic solids, just putting it with graphic tape onto a globe of Earth. And he found that if he aligned it with the center of one of the pentagonal faces onto the North Pole and another one on the South Pole, he could spin that figure around so that the points, or the called the vertexes of the dodecahedron, fell right on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought, okay, here's a physical pattern that ties to the dodecahedron, which Plato said was the most important figure in all of life. And then he asked the engineer, Makarov, if they could get together and work on this with the linguist who was, you know, back in Moscow. And the three of them started playing around with alignments and brought in colleagues of theirs from one of the universities in Moscow. And the archaeological alignments that they uncovered fell out from just symmetrically placing an icosahedron over the dodecahedron on this little 12-inch model of Earth.
Hmm.
And so we always thought, before I met him, that the grid had somehow been aligned with the Great Pyramid. But now I kind of think that maybe the model fell out from some kind of alignment with the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And if Atlantis was out there, I have no doubt that they had some knowledge of that ridge and its shape.
Mm-hmm. Three Russians, were they able to plot any major ruins of ancient cities with the grid that they created?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's mm-hmm. essentially the same grid that we use. The only thing that we changed in it was that they had an icosahedron and a dodecahedron on top of each other, and Becker, who, you know, I worked with on the grid, was worked with Buckminster Fuller, and he said, well, this is a great structure, except that its structure doesn't energetically work that way. The energy would flow around the outside in great circles. That was Fuller's whole mm-hmm. idea of geodesics. And so we just added on what he said were like missing struts in a geodesic dome. And that's why the picture of our grid is all made up of circles.
Fascinating. The Russians in their grid, can you name any of the sites, any of the ancient sites that they discovered were on these grids?
Oh, yeah. You can start off, there's the Great Pyramid. Now, again, when you say with specificity and all that, and this was one of the reasons why I kind of stopped working with identifying specific sites on the Earth, because, you know, they were working with 8-inch graphic tape on a 12-inch diameter world globe.
Oh, right, okay.
And so, you know, like that strip of tape was about 200 miles wide.
Yeah.
And it assumed that the Earth was spherical.
Right.
And it isn't quite, you know, and so when I made there was, they didn't identify all these sites, but using their alignment, the sites at Corral in Peru fall there, and on a grid point, and Giza, and Chengdu in China, and the Four Corners area is very near, in the United States, Point 17 is near the Hohokam Ancient Canals, huge waterwork system. Mm-hmm. And Chernobyl happened just, you know, oddly enough, just a few miles from the grid point in the Ukraine.
Chernobyl is on one of the points? Wow.
It's very close. Wow. You know, this is where for me, I put a little circle around what I call the grid point, and figured, okay, at a scale of 25,000 mile circumference, even 50 miles is close to a big intersection.
Right.
you know, because where's the tip? You know, is the point, if you have to have the whole grid 200 miles above the Earth, or where is it so that you have a circle, or I mean have a sphere around the Earth to talk about these intersections?
Hmm. That's fascinating.
And it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're basically saying that
you can't really be precise with something that big.
Yeah. From the Russians' Earth grid, there's obviously you created your grid with Becker, but is it an evolutionary kind of thing because the grids, the vortices in the grids change, or is it just one of those things that you just have to keep moving the grid based on intuition? What would you say?
Oh, that's the question I struggle with most of the time.
okay.
Have you seen Richard? Did you get a chance to take a look at Richard Montauk's sliding grid?
I didn't. Why don't you tell us about that? Because that's fascinating. I haven't seen it.
Well, the one that I made for Google Earth is composed of 121 great circles, and it's one of Buckminster Fuller's he calls it icosahedral great circle set. But what it is it's a really elaborate grid so that you can get down to lines maybe 100 miles apart rather than 1,400 miles apart. We put it onto the Earth, and one of the things that showed up using that grid on the way we had it placed was that it sort of outlined, it ran a line right along the Michael Mary line in southern Britain. Do you know that one?
Vaguely.
Well, it's one that some of the Earth Energy people that I met with really early on, Paul Devereaux and Nigel Pinnock, those guys, they considered that to be a well-established energy line, you know, full of lays and cathedrals and ancient stone markers and megaliths and just, you know, everything along that line. And it lined up with this this particular, more elaborate grid that Fuller had talked about. So Montauk took that program that I had, or whatever you call it, the KMZ file for Google Earth, and made it so that you could put the pattern of energy lines anywhere you wanted to. You could just slide it around on the Earth. It didn't have to be tied to the North and South Pole. And people move the grid around on the Earth. They can manipulate it on Google Earth now. And you can find very convincing evidence for lineups because there's so much information out there that once you see an alignment, you know, like between two sites that are very important, and then you tie it around to the other side of the Earth, Peter Shampoo's been doing that. There's almost an infinite number of really credible Earth energy alignments with sites that are much, much more sophisticated in terms of what's known about them now, with all the people who are looking at ancient sites compared to what was available 30 years ago.
Hmm.
And who's to say which one is correct, because there's so many convincing arguments.
Well, I guess the question I have to ask you, as somebody who's been researching this, is what did the early civilizations understand? I mean, Burke has shown that a number of these mounds were built over geomagnetic fields. He also showed that sophisticated pyramid complexes, and the one he specifies is the Tikal pyramid, the New World pyramid, was built over this geomagnetic field. I mean, what was the technology they used to find these and build on top of them? I mean, there must have been something that they had that we just don't possess. And you make a good point that we are so bombarded with radio frequencies and microwave frequencies on cell phones that we're probably blocked into being able to be sensitive. But you don't spend thousands and thousands of hours building a complex, a pyramid complex with man hours, unless you have a pretty good idea what you're building on top of. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that the Earth's electromagnetic energies are manipulable, and that have you ever had a really bad migraine headache and healed yourself with a boulder?
A boulder? No. No.
I had a really bad migraine when I went to meet Paul Devereaux in Wales, and he took me out to this place where I sat on a big granite, it might as well have been a stone rocking chair, and I sat there, and within a couple of minutes, my headache was gone. So I had no doubt that there was something about the properties of granite that did something. I didn't attribute it to the site at that time. I just took it to granite. But, I mean, when you look at the size of those structures, you know, like the pyramid in Tikal, the amount of granite, you know, and granite is really a light beam when you think of it. You know, it's made up of mica and all these reflective electromagnetic components. You can create magnetic sites. I think you can change the properties of water. I don't know this. I just believe this because what Bill Corliss had, who used to produce those Unexplained Earth books.
Yeah, I love his stuff. Old stuff, but it's still
did you
good.
Read about where he talked about the Maya constructing really very elaborate, heavy stone granite pyramids? And at the base of every one of them was water. And the idea seemed to be that the granite, just like mountains, was drawing water in a geometric pattern. They laid out the pyramids essentially like a honeycomb.
I have only one of his books, but I will definitely look that up. Maya pyramids and drawing water. Because that's last week we had, or a couple of weeks ago, we had Chris Dunn, who talks about the Great Pyramid, and there's underground canals that carried water underneath the pyramid. And they think that the pyramid produced an energy with the use of water. So it's pretty amazing. And it's another one of those ancient mysteries we just don't understand. It's a lost technology, a lost science, basically.
Well, you can find it again if you put, you know, big structures of granite in a field and watch what happens to the property of the soil and the hydrology under the big stones and in the areas between them.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
So you don't have any feeling, anything. You believe that this placement of these sacred sites in America, the mounds and the pyramids in Central America and throughout the world, may not have been on a ley line, but more were just placed in an area where, with the combination of water and other earth elements, they produced some kind of energy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know, for as many as you find on, you find as many off. But I believe that they were using, I think they wanted to create, and I think that they had a better understanding of where the forces were and how to align them to a purpose.
Hmm.
I mean, what I noticed was that in the there's one particular kind of grid point, the one that's at the center of that map, you know, the Deaconestris map. Most of those centers are associated with fairly significant constructed irrigation systems.
Okay.
You know, like world famous irrigation systems. And that just leads me to believe that they were enhancing a property of the earth. That makes me think that the 62 major grid points that we call them, do have properties. I believe that the properties where six triangles come together are associated with significant resource deposits. And I believe
okay.
that, you know, but whether all the little sites and everything, whether they're along lines or whether they're, they must have been capillaries of some energy system. But I feel like
I just wonder if there was like one individual, like say in Egypt, or one individual, or not one individual, but one person. It might come down to no technology, but just somebody who's so sensitive to these pulsating geomagnetic fields, they would say, okay, this is very strong here, build here. Or and I also believe that there was an earlier technology that was, it's gone, a civilization, you know, prior to the Maya may have left their knowledge, or the Maya inherited a knowledge that allowed them to understand these natural currents and then build on top of the ones that were the strongest, with the purpose of, I mean, this is another question for you, is, I mean, Burke in his book basically says that they built pyramids for seed propagation or seed enhancement to grow these amazing seeds. But it just blows me away, and I would have loved to have talked to the man. Unfortunately,
yeah.
He passed away. But why build this complex engineering feat, very tall, very heavy pyramid for just seed development? It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, what is your thinking about that? I mean, must be some other reason for that.
Well, let me go back to the first thing you said. I agree with you that there are people who are sensitive, and I absolutely know beyond a doubt that I can communicate with plants, but I sure can't communicate with other, you know, like I can't feel in you know, granite fields other than having a migraine taken away. And I've had a dowser, Andy Davy, he's not alive anymore, which is really sad, from Scotland, who put his hands, he was a very experienced dowser, he would just put his hands on my shoulders and not do anything, not try to manipulate me, anything. He just put his hands on my shoulders, and I could douse. And as soon as he took his hands off my shoulders, I was clueless as usual. You know, and so I do believe that those people were more valued in the past. I have no problem with that at all. I've seen people with bull roars bring clouds out of a sunny day and rain. You know, I do think some people really are sensitive. But as far as the, you know, like building the huge monuments, besides as you know, like as symbols of power, you know, as their own little, their own big monuments to self, I think that they had other purposes. Like I'm very interested in the how sound and granite and those structures interact. Do you know at the top of the Tikal pyramid, there's a thing that they call, the anthropologists call, a roof cone?
Yeah, I've studied those. Those are fascinating. Yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah,
because you know you don't very often see sound being shown through a square grid.
Let's go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, we probably came to the same insight.
Well, you know what's funny is that when I started studying Mayan architecture, these grids were on specific kinds of buildings, and I think that there was an architectural intent to place them in the direction of certain wind flow. And the natives told me, the one elder told me, that they would produce a resonance of sound at certain times of day that were frequencies of healing, or they produce different kinds of sound. And they haven't been studied with any great depth because academic science doesn't acknowledge that as a possible, a purpose. You know, that's just beyond their focus. But it's funny because they place great, great emphasis on these combs that are on these roofs. And I think it probably, you're right, they probably resonated into the buildings themselves and may have imbued the people who were in those buildings with possible energy of some kind. What do you think?
I am so glad to hear you say that. I have shivers going up and down my spine. Seriously, I have thought about this. What's so funny is just today I read an article about acoustic experiments that are being done in the early Gothic cathedrals. I mean, I'm not an expert. I don't even know much about it other than from, you know, Civ in college. But that now they're doing really interesting experiments about how the grooves in the inside of cathedrals and placing jugs at certain levels above the floor of the cathedral, that when sound was made, they've actually been able to like recreate the fluttering of angels' wings.
Wow.
In sound, and talking about the whole consciousness shifting experiment, and then putting an organ on top of that and being able to introduce infrasonics and alter consciousness. You must be right that that's what they were doing with those roof combs.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
This is what's fascinating about the Maya, and I've written articles. I got to get more time to do more about it, but they, not only were they geniuses in engineering feats, and of course the sciences, medicine, and astronomy, and mathematics, things like that, they had an understanding of Earth energies that we just do not understand. And it's really irritating for me to see these displays of Maya walking around in loincloths and stuff like that. My feeling is, and I talk about this on the show, is that they basically inherited a lot of their knowledge from an earlier civilization. And that could be, if you follow Edgar Cayce, who is a seer, we don't have any documentation that the Maya inherited from places like Lemuria, like Atlantis, people who came from very, very high civilized, technologically advanced cultures. Now, it's funny if you study and you read some of these early descriptions of places like Atlantis, they used piezoelectric energy.
Mm-hmm.
They used energy that was earth-based or crystal-based. That we use piezoelectric energy today, but we use it in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
But, scientists are dumbfounded by the Maya. They just don't get it. And what we see as evidence of the Maya are these bloodthirsty people who basically are the remnants, the last, people left from a once proud culture. And I think they're thousands and thousands and thousands of years older than what we understand. So that's my two cents. So when we talk about the roof combs, that's just one of many things. And you brought up something that I find interesting that I need to pay more attention to, and that is the channeling of water into these structures and the properties of granite, which we've heard of from people like Chris Dunn and other research scientists, and their place in these buildings. But what I want to hear from you, Beth, and why I think it's important for us to understand what you've discovered is, you've discovered energy on a personal scale with your bull rods and your spinners and things like that, but that's on an individual scale. Can you talk to us about what your impressions are of these vortexes and how they may have penetrated these buildings and maybe what was the thinking behind them? What's your intuition about that? Because it's funny because you're an anthropologist, right? So you have to basically mm-hmm. throw your education out the window and you start talking about this stuff because that's such a conflict for you. It must be a horrible conflict to go, okay, I'm not supposed to think about this, but I have to.
But, you know, I never went into that I'm not supposed to think about this mentality.
Oh, really?
Well, I am able to, listen, and I got my credentials. I went to the University of Chicago and got a very good traditional PhD. And that has served me very well, because I think what you have to have in your arsenal is create your own creative spirit. And if you don't follow your heart, you're dead. And I knew right away that in traditional academics, if I didn't follow my heart, I was going to be dead. But if you use critical thinking in your own work, you don't have to feel beaten down. I've had people make fun of me, but usually it's just, ideas. You know, I got laughed off the face of the college when I was talking about solar energy in the 70s, and look at it now. You know, I mean, it just takes a while, and you just have to say, okay, so you don't like it, so what? And do your thing. But I think that I know you don't think of the bull roars as important in this whole vortex context, but I think that one of the problems in traditional academics is that they see, and this isn't all traditional academics, obviously, this is just, the stereotype of the ones that want to sell textbooks, is that if you see humans as being things on Earth but not of Earth, you've lost the game right there. Because if you have, in really sacred ceremonies in the South Pacific, like Papua New Guinea, so I've worked in Papua New Guinea and in Australia, little tiny technologies like bull roars, which are just, you probably made one when you were a kid. You have a wood ruler with a hole in the end. You tie a string, spin it over your head, and it makes a buzzing sound. Did you ever make
right.
one of those?
Yeah, I actually did. I was looking at a video the other day of you demonstrating, what do you call those things? Spinners. I made a couple of spinners that made those sounds. You know, you pull them and they make that cool sound. That's what I've made.
Well, those spinners are just, those are also found all over the world, and they go back, 40,000 years, the bull roars and the spinners. They found them even in the caves in France. I mean, they're really, really old, and you can just see some little kid, picking up his mother's spindle if she's at a point where she can weave, and you knew that the kids are going to be with the mother because, that's who takes care of the kids when the men are out. And he starts spinning it around, and it creates this annoying buzzing sound. I think that the adults learn from the kids and adapt what the their little annoying discoveries do. And with those bull roars, they sound kind of like a magnified dragonfly, or there's some in some of the Yoruba African lore. There's descriptions of these things as insects, but they in a cluster in Papua New Guinea, for when they were initiating little boys to become adults, they would have 500 men on the beach at a time when the wind was a certain way and the sea, you know, the sea waves were a certain way. It might as well have been the granite of the Maya, you know, where they're playing with the wind over a structured surface, adding in 500 people swinging bull roars and telling the kids that it was something that was going to come down and eat them if they weren't brave, and they're in little huts, you know, trying to not wet their pants, you know.
yeah.
But you get this incredible infusion of vortex power from the real wind, the 500 bull roars, you know, creating there's a crossbeat resonance of the sound of the bull roars that creates an infrasonic frequency, below 20 hertz, that's just like the organs in the cathedrals, or probably just like the wind in through those roof combs inside the structures, so that everybody's energy becomes part of the earth consciously.
Yeah.
And if you've got all that infused into place and memory, you have a really powerful spot. You can create one.
For those in the audience who don't know what a bull rod is, can you describe it? Because it's very old. It's a way to create a self generating energy field, and it's fascinating, and you're really actually. I want you to tell us how you healed yourself with a bull rod. But tell us basically how it works.
Well, it's just a flat piece of wood or bone or ivory or stone. Some of them are made out of flint, and you know the tongue coming out of the Aztec calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's
the shape of a classic bull roar.
Hmm.
And I think it is a bull roar. There's a lot of evidence that the tekpatl, you know, the knife of sacrifice, was used also as a bull roar. But in the more common ones made out of wood, if you could just imagine a 12-inch wood ruler with a hole drilled in one end,
right,
and tie a string on it, and then you swing it over your head so that it makes a circle, and the wood starts spinning on its long axis, and it just creates a fast fluttering sound at about 110 hertz. And the reason I think that's significant, and this is worldwide, the Yoruba and the the name's just gone right out of my head, but the Santeria religions associate prophecy from the Orisas, the female character, as being the sound of the bull roar.
Hmm.
And so Nicky Hart, do you know him?
Sure, the drummer?
Yeah. Well, in his drum, I know this, Drumming at the Edge of Magic, there's a section in there where he talks about making himself one of these bull roars, and he says that he would spin it over his head for about 15 minutes and be gone.
Meaning that he would go into an altered state of consciousness?
Yeah.
Huh.
He said it just took about 15 minutes. And it's
so
really
tell us
hard.
What's your theory? What's your theory on a bull roar? Is it that by spinning this bone, this piece of wood above your head, the ancients could create an individual vortex around them, because obviously you're pushing wind and other elements that we don't see around your circumference, your physical circumference, and what's happening? It's pulling air down and it's pulling energy up. So what do you think is happening? What's going on?
I think you're altering your field. You know, every single molecule in your body is spinning. Every, you know, element, everything's spinning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from Reiki, you know, when you breathe, you're actually breathing a column of spinning air in and out of your body. Your blood is running through running through your veins in a spiral that doesn't just go through straight like in the commercials with the fish. It follows a spiral pattern. And if you have a, the burr comes, it makes almost an hourglass figure around you where it'll be lower and then it'll come to a middle plane and go higher. And it, I think it creates a resonance with the natural spin of who you are. And if you alter the strength or the, you know, the direction or whatever of a vortex, you can, you know, like what happens when you see water going down a bathtub, you know, it's quite a power and you can alter it.
Okay. Now you have used it yourself and you talk about in an article that I read that you actually healed yourself. Now, what did you do, a daily spin and change your cellular structure? What do you think happened when you were doing this?
Well, I had Lyme disease, and I was when I got it, I was really intensely involved in an academic job. And I had to take a 6-month leave, and I decided that what I was going to do was make reproductions of all the borers that I could find pictures of. And at the time, there weren't very many pictures of borers. You know, it's probably one of the most it's a signal icon of anthropology. It's one of the first things that you learn about because they're so ubiquitous. But I got into the, as I was making them, and following the patterns that some of the earlier anthropologists, like from the end of the 1900s, or I mean 1800s, had drawn, I could feel the carving that the makers of them had. You know, like I would try to copy a pattern and I'd make a mistake exactly the same place that they did, because of the properties of the wood. And then I would, it took quite a while to get sort of an aerodynamic plane in the back and be tied just right and find a string that would work better than others.
Okay.
And I made about 250 of them. I mean, it was really just obsession with borers. I made them for about 6 months, nonstop. I just couldn't get them out of my mind. And tried every one of them out and swung them out in our backyard, which is filled with granite. And I don't know whether it was the practice, you know, like the constancy of thinking, breathing, spinning, testing that did it, but I got over the lines.
Wow.
But I don't know whether that was, you know, like, you know how it is when you have a driving passion. And maybe the borer, just for me, brought together all the things about spin that I needed to know, because I was so skeptical of earth energies. I love geometry, but I thought basically that it was just my imagination that things were happening.
Fascinating. Did you ever encounter a time in your spinning where you went into that altered state of consciousness, or did you do it enough to have a sense of a change in perspective?
I mean,
was it like
know.
A drug? How's that? Was it like a drug? No, I'm not joking.
No, but I mean, it's a good question. Have you ever done ayahuasca?
No. My girlfriend and I talk about it, but no, I haven't done it yet. I'm afraid of that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, I shouldn't be, but I am.
No, I'm with you. I spent quite a while just not even thinking about it, and then about 4.5 years ago, somebody said, "I think we found your shaman," and I went to Peru and I did an ayahuasca dieta for 12 days, and it all made sense. You know, I could see, I mean, I don't ever intend to do it again, to be honest with you, because it was so intense, but I had, you know, like fasted for 6 months before I went, stopped drinking coffee, stopped drinking wine, walked, bought Pure Thoughts. I mean, just, you know, I really cleansed, and I went, and the person who was organizing this dieta had, it was an MD, and had asked us all, and a indigenous person, but to write down what we wanted to find out when we experienced this plant. And I said, I really want to understand my need to control.
Hmm.
And, you know, because the whole thing of the bull roars and the energy grid and what's right and what's wrong and what could have and why are we so locked in this view of, you know, that our technology, just because it's plastic and it's shiny, that it's, you know, sophisticated, which it is, but it's not the only way. Anyway, it was the most valuable experience I've ever had in my life. It was the first time I ever saw genealogy as a spiral. You know, like I really understood the vortex of the two families that became, you know, me.
Interesting. So you came away from your experience with ayahuasca. You felt that was positive, and you learned some things, I guess.
Oh, it was incredibly positive.
Okay.
I honestly don't think I've been, you know, sometimes I would get really depressed about all this stuff, and I don't think I've been depressed in 4.5 years after that.
Wow. Okay. Well.
But again, you know, it's where when you, you know, Mickey Hart is an extremely disciplined musician. You know, and I think if you just go out and you stand in the yard and you swing the bull roar over your head for 15 minutes, and you don't have intention, I don't think you'd go anywhere. I mean, I really mm-hmm. believe that the human electromagnetic engine is really a factor in all this stuff, and that your brain is a,
mm-hmm.
you know, an engine.
Would you say there is an innate intelligence behind the grids and the vortexes that you've described?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, when I say innate intelligence, a universal, an energy, some kind of a living. Intelligence that lives within these energies that kind of understand, and it's all part of, it's kind of hard to describe what I'm thinking, but I'm just thinking some kind of intelligence that is within this energy. That's about as close to as an explanation as I can, or an answer or a question that I can form.
Well, I'll go out on a limb and say yes.
Okay, and why do you believe that?
Well, let me go back to my old buddy Plato. What he says, and I'll tie it to a personal experience and so you can see what I mean. He describes this grid, the grid of 120 triangles, calls it the divine mother or the nurse of becoming, and it's female, and it shivers, and it has no material reality, and yet it holds matter. And he even says that if you try to see matter as this perfect, as this form, that you're never going to find it because it doesn't exist. But it's like an infinitely dark geometric being that's the mother of becoming. And when I was I like that concept. I mean, I think that the interpretation of, you know, like ideals that's been attributed to Plato is off mark. But when I was really immersed in writing something a few years ago, and I had an out-of-body experience, which I never have, and I was just out in the middle of I don't know what. It was black, and I could see the whole, you know, it looked like I was inside of, at the center of the universe, looking at the structure of the Divine Mother in that darkness, even though I couldn't see it. I mean, I can't explain what it was, but it was just like I came to this sense of really, really complete peace. And all the things that I'd been thinking about there being a grid in the sky and a grid in the earth and a grid in molecules and grid, when I came back to, you know, sitting at my desk and looking at my typewriter, I had this feeling of absolutely no curiosity. You know, it was like I already knew everything. And I mean, I don't mean to say that pompous, but just, you know, like that everything that I needed to know, I knew, and I just stopped researching. And that makes me think that there's something intelligent about this.
Okay. That's kind of cool. Like the all-knowing, you become the all-knowing being in your pursuit. So there's no
and
more
pursuit.
And you
don't want to say you're God
know.
Or anything, but then you know, like if it really is one being, then I like that. But then you have all the, you know, like coming in from all the studies of everything recently saying, well, symmetry is an assumption of our culture and geometry isn't perfect. But I keep thinking, okay, but if there is this intelligence that is holding, that's how I like to think of the grid energy.
That's fascinating. You know, I have to read something that I think is something that you wrote here. It says, Beth Hagen's inquiry spans the relatively new interdisciplinary field of anthropology of consciousness, which merges cultural anthropology, neurobiology, psychology, and the art and humanities to create theory, social action, peace, and performance art. Would you like to see courses on, as you call it, anthropology of consciousness?
Oh, yeah, they exist even.
Do they really? Okay.
Yeah, you know, there's, believe it or not, within the American Anthropological Association, we have a subsection that's called the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness. And we have a journal.
Wow.
And
I just think anything in that realm taught in a university or college setting, you know, should also include things like meditation. Because if college students learn how to meditate or did moving meditation like Tai Chi or even yoga, I think it would open up some real, real amazing creativity and maybe even bend and start giving the academics a new insight. Because I think we have a lot of problems when it comes to education in America, at least, where possible discoveries are downplayed or ignored. And thoughts that don't follow a linear focus or point of view are put aside. You know, I think a good example is the native point of view of Earth, and we don't look at the native's point of view because it's not documented well. It's only pretty much oral history, and but I think if an anthropologist, and they have done this. I know they've done this, and I can't think of the person or the groups who have done this and actually gone through various native tribes and recorded their oral histories. And Frank Walters wrote a book on the Hopi; it's very famous.
Yeah, but
I mean, to really track that information, they'd find that there's a there's a compelling and there's a storyline that goes through a lot of different cultures, and we just don't consider that. So consciousness, and as an educational tool, I think would serve us a lot better, and maybe that's something we are going to look into in the future after we're all gone.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up that example because where I am now at Walden in the doctoral program, I based the plan for their progress through their dissertation writing on the 9 limbs of yoga.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, because, you know, the stages and the ethics and the, you know, I just thought this works perfectly. And the school, you know, I'm actually this week in a faculty seminar on spirituality in the classroom. But the one that I get the hassle from is the IRS, because they refuse to acknowledge that my professional expenses to, you know, do sophisticated yoga training or, you know, experiment with granite. They think that that's who's opposed to this new way of being. Because, you know, you can legitimately write anybody. Many people could write that off as in any number of categories in their life if they were itemizing their income taxes.
Wow.
You know, once we start making the world be one thing, they're dead.
Yeah. Hey, in the final minutes we have here, I want you to dig into your repository of knowledge on grids. And tell us, what's the biggest decode behind these grids? And The decode. What's the decode behind the grids and what you've discovered about energy and these grids as they apply to us as living, breathing people? What do we need to know?
What do you mean by decode?
Well, how you interpret this material. How do we... you know, obviously the ancients understood these subtle energies because they didn't have a lot of modern technology interfering with their subtle detectors, sensitivities, and things like that to be able to tell where these energies were coming from and how to use them. And what do we need to know? What is the takeaway from your understanding on how we should use this?
Well, my takeaway, I guess, is that the heart always knows. And if your heart calls you to a particular interpretation or experience or experiment, you will be acting in terms of your greater good. You'll amplify your own power, and you will... be kind to others and to the earth. And if your head is behind it, you are likely looking for personal power. And if your head aligns with your heart, I think go with it. And it doesn't matter who says you're wrong. But I really think it has to engage your heart. It's a pretty simplistic answer, but... You know, I've seen some fantastic work that I totally disagree with, but just because my sense of reasoning doesn't go there. But have you ever played with a moiré grid? Well, try it sometime. Do you know what a line grid is?
Yeah, sure.
I'm just, you know, like you have a little, maybe the lines are 1/16 of an inch thick and a 1/16 of an inch apart. Just get two of them and overlay them on top of each other and twist one of them if they're on transparency paper. And I think that the patterns that the ancients used arose out of multiple grids on top of each other, creating patterns that were reconciliations. I mean, you know, when they talk about the 9 levels of heaven, I mean, what if they really are different levels? And what if, you know, since everything's always swirling, what if, you know, out of the swirling of the levels on top of each other, patterns arose? And what if that's the way it works with human intelligence and difference and discovery? You know, that it's not a linear progress from here to there, but it's heart belief in a kind way, you know, in a collaborative, compassionate way. I mean, it's so against the profit system and the get ahead, but I really believe that.
I think what you just triggered a little bit in your what you just said is that I think the society we live in right now isn't really a natural, helpful society for individual evolution. I think we have to struggle against it. And the monetary system and fighting to make a living, and because, you know, obviously everyone, you have to make money to survive. In America and in Europe, there are systems to help you when you get older, but it's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah.
So, boy.
No, I don't. But I mean, I don't have children. I couldn't have children. And so I had the luxury of being able to follow my heart. And so that's why I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and other people will have, but if, I just think you can't go wrong if you follow your heart. Even if you're working in a dead end job, if your heart is with something, it'll keep you going. You know, you look at those sadhus in India, you know, that are folded up on the ground and their heart is in being poor and being a totally delivering their being to the universe. You know, we don't even understand that in the United States, I think.
We can't understand that because the person's in poverty and barely existing on a day-to-day basis, and we're all looking to the future going, what am I going to do when I'm older? What am I going to do? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Listen,
and
this
you can't
been,
be stupid.
Yeah, yeah. You can't be what?
You know, like, I think you can, at some point, I think I'd rather be dead than not be with my heart, because I feel I make myself sick when I get off my heart. I know it now. It took me long enough to discover that. But
so your advice for people is to follow your heart. Follow what your heart intelligence is. Your heart's telling your brain, and then you do that, and you'll find happiness.
I think that's the word that's being used now. I don't know whether it's happiness, but you'll find purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a kind of intelligence that will see you through bad times.
Interesting. Well,
this has been a fascinating conversation. I haven't thought about this stuff, and thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, listen, where can we hear you? Are you going to be speaking at any conferences this spring, summer, or fall?
Well, probably not, Cliff. You know, I work at the school. I'm going to South Africa in May.
Okay.
So if anybody's in South Africa, they're welcome to look me up.
I always ask because some of our speakers are and authors are traveling and doing tours. But do give us your website. What's your web address? Because I want people to know about it.
It's just, I have to look it up just a minute.
I did have it 1 second.
I can't remember whether. Just a minute. This is embarrassing. it's bethe.missionignition.net.
Okay, email that to me. I'll post it on our Facebook page and make sure.
And
that
I'll give
people...
you my Granite Garden page just in case anybody's interested in looking at the experiments around here.
Oh, of course. Go ahead.
I mean, I'll send that in the email to you.
Oh, you'll send it an email. Okay, so those of you who
and
are
if
listening...
anybody's in the Boston, Kennebunkport area, you know, please have them feel free to get hold of me because I love to have, you know, I love to talk with people, so.
Fantastic. Okay. Hey, it's been a real pleasure. I'm going to be checking back with you again because I think we have more to talk about, especially regarding the... vortexes in the in these sacred places and how water is used, because I have some work to do on that subject. So,
well, we
I'll
should
be
definitely
in touch.
Do something on the roof combs too.
Yeah, the roof combs are one of those things that I found when I was down in Mexico, and it's funny that, you know, well, that's a whole nother discussion. One of the biggest problems, I'm just going to say this real quickly, and I learned this from reading some of the early archaeologists who were building and reconstructing places like Tikal and Chichen Itza and some of the other Mayan places, is that they had to guess at rebuilding. They had no blueprints. And so a lot of these buildings are put up half-ass and with not really knowing what's going on. And
yeah,
they would and they put these combs up, and I can tell, just you can just feel that they're wrong. They're wrong, but they're still up there. So luckily, most of the for those listening, most of the ruins, when you go to Yucatan or any place in Central America that have Maya or other native ruins, pretty much they do a pretty good job when they build them. But in some cases, they just rushed them and they're butchered. So, and I hate to see that, because they build them with a certain intent, with a certain kind of intelligence that we don't use in our buildings today. And of course, they use natural material, which is very cool. So anyhow, that's another discussion. Beth, thank you very much. And I look forward to chatting again.
Yeah, well, you too, and have a wet weekend.
Thank you. We will.
Okay,
it's
take care.
Raining right now, so I'll be in touch. So that's our program today, and thanks for joining us. I want to mention that we're going to have Michael Tellinger on the program again. He's going to be communicating from South Africa on some of his new work. And he is part of a TV program that I think he's co-presenting that I want to talk to him about. So he's going to be joining the program. And the other thing is, keep an eye on Blog Talk Radio. I don't know where you're listening from, but if you can, go to, not this week, but in the next week, go to blogtalkradio.com and find Earth Ancients, and our network is going to start building. Keep it on your radar. And on this program, I will promote our hosts as they come forth and the programming that we develop. It's going to be pretty interesting. I think you'll get a kick out of it. So anyhow, stay tuned for that. All right, I hope you have a great day, and stay tuned for our next program.